the House Committee on Redistricting today, and I believe the House has a bit of business to take care of before we begin on our agenda.
Call to order the House Committee on Redistricting, and we have an organizational meeting for purposes of adopting committee rules. They've been distributed to members, and so, Mr. Co-Chair, I would ask for a motion, please.
Sure. Co-Chair Garrett, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 4, 2011, and amended with rule number 20.
Co-Chair Lindsay moves to adopt proposed rules dated February 4, 2011, and amended by rule number 20. Any discussion on the rules? Any objection? Motion passes. Rules are adopted. And now we will turn it over, I think, to Senator Bonamici to preside over the informational meeting for today.
Thank you, Representative Garrett. And welcome to everyone who's here today, both in the hearing room and watching either on the Oregon Channel or streaming online. This is our first meeting of the redistricting committee other than our organizational meeting earlier. And what we're doing today is having what looks to be a very thorough review, an overview of redistricting. It's an honor to have with us today as our first presenter with us on the telephone and on a PowerPoint presentation, Professor Justin Levitt from the Brennan Center for Justice and Loyola University. And I know, Professor Levitt, can you hear all right? And we want to make sure people can hear you.
I can hear you just fine.
Okay. Can people in the audience hear Professor Levitt? Terrific. And Professor Levitt, before you begin your presentation, I want to make just a comment about the Citizens Guide to Redistricting that I know you put together, I believe, when you were at the Brennan Center for Justice. And I want to say that I found it to be an extremely helpful resource and have recommended it to other committee members as well as others in the community. And I know that it's been very helpful and very thorough citizen's guide, and I think it will inform our conversation today. And if you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and your background, and then I'll let you take it away with your PowerPoint presentation. Thank you, Professor Levitt.
And thank you very much, Senator, and all the other members of the Assembled Committee for the invitation to speak to you today. I'm really here for you, so I very much hope, I have a presentation prepared as a guideline, but I very much hope that you'll ask any questions that you have, because I want to inform you about the things that you wish to know. Exactly as mentioned, I come from the Brennan Center for Justice. I'm now an associate professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Both at the Brennan Center before and now as an academic, I have studied in extensive detail the redistricting process across the country. Local processes and state processes, and informed by a little bit of on-the-ground observation and participation in jurisdictions actually accomplishing redistricting, all the way through to participation in the, unfortunately, inevitable litigation after redistricting plans are passed, when the second stage of redistricting begins. And I'll say we, former colleagues at the Brennan Center and I, have looked at how the process works and the rules for the process around the country, and have tried in particular to present the various options the various states use, and to inform people about how their own local communities redistrict, how they conduct the process, in a way that is both thorough and accessible. So without skimping on the detail, without glossing over important twists and turns in the law, to help people actually understand what this is and why we do it. And I'm honored to have that opportunity again. I'm not sure how many members of the committee have been through a redistricting cycle, but we've done this with people who've been at it for 5 decades and want to find out what the latest from the Supreme Court entails, and with people who've never put pen to paper or virtual pen to virtual paper in drawing a redistricting plan. So we try to make engage at whatever level people wish us to engage.
Thank you so much, Professor. And I think as we begin the PowerPoint presentation, if it works for you, I'd rather take questions as we go along rather than hold them to the end of the presentation.
Absolutely.
All right, terrific. All right, then we'll go ahead and start. And just to respond to that question, I believe that several members of the committee have been through the redistricting process 10 years ago, and several have not. So we're a mixed group among us, both in the House and in the Senate.
Okay, well, for the experts, I'll beg a little bit of indulgence. The presentation I prepared was an attempt to get everybody up to the same level and on the same page. And so, to the extent that this is all old news, I'll beg your indulgence for just a little bit. The presentation I prepared today, part of it was done while at the Brennan Center. It's similar to, it's tailored to Oregon, obviously, but similar to presentations that I had done while at the Brennan Center, so that's why you see that logo there. I do want to make clear that I am no longer employed by them and don't speak for them, although they do have some truly exceptional resources, both people and materials, to offer if you are interested. The approach that I generally take draws heavily from fourth grade journalism and attempts to go through a very, very basic level the questions that people have, and there are fairly consistent questions. I find that it's useful to start the conversation with returning to why we do redistricting at all, other than the fact that the law tells us we have to, because it's, I think, useful grounding for what the process is meant to achieve. So starting with the why, this will be familiar to some of you, perhaps. It's the original gerrymander from 1812, and this was a district that was drawn in part to help one particular political party maintain control of the Massachusetts state legislature. It was viewed as somewhat contorted, although I think you all have seen far worse, and was given the wings and the claws and the teeth by local editorial cartoonist Elbridge Gerry, who signed the plan into law, attached his name to the beginning, and that's how we get the gerrymander. The reason I bring this up isn't just historical interest, and not only because I'm a professor, but also because it shows that in the way back when, districts were often made of towns or counties, or groups of towns or counties. And if you look at Massachusetts as towns or counties, this is a map of just municipal boundaries in Massachusetts, most of which are fairly regular. Not the case, obviously, in most of the rest of the country. You can actually see the gerrymander right in the northeast of the state. That's that is the outline of the original towns that comprise the gerrymander. If you look at that same district now, just blowing up that portion of the northeast of Massachusetts, each district were drawn so as to have roughly the same number of people when they were first put in place. So you might have one state senator from the gerrymander district representing, obviously, illustrative 10 people, one state senator from Boston to the south representing 10 people, one state senator from the northeast representing 10 people. And over time, growth rates change, people move, population shifts, and the districts become wildly imbalanced. In the 1960s, the Supreme Court decided a series of cases, beginning with Baker versus Carr, that amounted to a constitutional mandate that districts, representative districts for legislatures, big and small, have to have roughly equal population. And so, when we know where the population is, every 10 years, we embark on redistricting. It follows the census because that's what tells us how we know how many people we have where. Who does redistricting? Well, obviously in Oregon it's mostly you all. You follow the national norm in some ways. In most of the states of the country, the legislature has primary control. State legislative districts, the state legislature draws the line in 37 states. Almost the same for congressional lines. Oregon structure starts with the state legislature, starts with you all. has one particular take on this process, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and that is if you can't agree, if you can't pass a plan and have it signed by the governor to draw state legislative districts, then the process will default to the Secretary of State. And for congressional districts, you all are essentially on your own. The legislature passes a law like any other statute. If the process gets too terribly late, courts will take over. I mentioned before that litigation is something of the norm. That's the map of the country where litigation was in some way, shape, or form a factor in the last cycle. You can see there were a few states that escaped, but by and large, at some point, a plan was drawn and brought into court. Those court challenges weren't always successful. This is just a map of where the plans were in some way litigated. Here, we start to break down what happened in the aftermath. Courts were asked to step in to evaluate state legislative lines in 33 states and to evaluate congressional lines in 21 states. And of some note, the court had at least some part in drawing part of a plan, if not the entire plan, itself in 11 states for the state legislative plan and in 9 states for the congressional plan. And I know that you've had experience with both of these scenarios in the past. Hardin v. Bradbury, in the last cycle on the state legislature, the court was asked to step in to evaluate the plan and ultimately upheld it. And in Congress, Perrin v. Kitzhaber case, in which the court actually was called on to draw some of a part of the plan itself, or actually to draw the entire plan, I believe. These plans can obviously be based heavily on steps that the legislature or factions of the legislature have taken thus far. They're often grounded in draft plans that have been drawn up at some stage in the process by the primary decision maker in Oregon, by the legislature. But they don't have to be. And in other states, the courts that have gotten involved, both state and federal court, have sometimes drawn from a relatively clean slate. When does all of this happen? Well, now, as you know, there are a few deadlines of note that you're probably already familiar with. The process really started in 2010 when, on April 1st, the federal census conducted business, tried to evaluate where people were across the country. Their statutory deadline to get you the results of that census is April 1st, 2011. In what's called the PLO 94-171 file. That's after Public Law 94-171. Federal law requires the census to deliver certain information to the states. The federal deadline for that is April 1st, but the Census Bureau has already rolled out the first 4 states on its list. It generally keeps an eye on the state's internal redistricting deadlines and tries to get data to states accordingly. So those states with the very early deadlines, mostly based around 2011 legislative elections in Virginia, New Jersey, Louisiana, I believe in Mississippi. The Census Bureau has rolled out that information already. Yours is coming. It will probably arrive before April 1st, but I don't know that they've set a schedule just yet for exactly when. By July 1st, 2011, Oregon state law, as you probably know, asks you to derive a state legislative plan. If there is no plan by then the process defaults to the Secretary of State, who will have until August 15th to file a plan. And it is always worth keeping in mind the litigation schedule thereafter. Where are the lines drawn? So now we've covered why we're doing this, the fact that you're all doing this, the fact that you're starting now, and this is really the 100,000-foot overview of how you make your decisions. There are 2 primary federal laws that you'll be asked to take into account. The first is equal population requirement. And we talked a little bit about that already, the Baker versus Carr decision and its aftermath in the 1960s, requiring that congressional lines really be as equally populated as possible. So there are rough guidelines of equal populations, but they get stricter for Congress, down to more or less mathematically equal. And I've taken this 766,000 person figure from the one piece of information the Census Bureau has given out from every state, and that's the total resident population. In order to apportion you members of Congress, the Census Bureau had to deliver by December 31st to the clerk of the House of Representatives the official counts, not of where all of the people were, but how many people there were per state. The sum total. They had to give the answer. And based on that, congressional seats were apportioned. And based on that, we know how many people you have and into how many districts you'll have to divide them. And what that means is you now know that you'll have to have more or less exactly 766,215 people per congressional district. That gives you a sense of the scope of the size of the districts you'll be drawing for Congress. For the state legislature, the constitutional mandate is to have substantially equal or roughly equal population. That has generally amounted to a little bit more latitude than in Congress. Has generally amounted to rough permission to have districts that deviate so that the gap between the largest district and the smallest district is 10%. Can be 5% over the average, can be 5% under the average, can be 6% over the average, 4% under the average, where the total gap is 10% or less, if there's a good reason for doing so. In litigation in the last cycle, there were districts that were within that 10% threshold, but the reason for drawing them within the 10% threshold, the reason for deviating at all, was to secure a partisan advantage. And the federal court there deemed that an impermissible reason to deviate, and so struck down the plan, even though it was within the generally recognized 10% degree of latitude. That case out of Georgia, woke everyone up to the fact that the standard is really to try to get to equal population, with the exception for good reasons. Good reasons can include a lot of things. They can include keeping communities together. They can include keeping political boundaries intact. They can include all sorts of other factors that we'll talk a little bit about. But pure partisan advantage, which I know you're not able to consider in Oregon redistricting, is not among them. And so deviating purely for that purpose was struck down. What does all of that mean? Well, your target in the state house is about 63,850 people. And I've labeled this as 63,850-ish because it's important to remember that you do have latitude. If there's a good reason to deviate, you can. Senate districts, unsurprisingly, will be twice as big. But those are the target numbers that you are aiming for. In the last cycle, I know that the Secretary of State kept the lines to within a 2% deviation, which is the smallest. And that was, as I understand it, a policy decision by the Secretary that's not legally required, but it is something that you'll want to consider.
Professor Levitt?
Yes.
Just a point of clarification. I think it's important to remember. So if I'm understanding it correctly, we might have a good reason that's sufficient to justify a small deviation in state legislative lines, but that would not be sufficient to support the same type of deviation in congressional lines, correct?
Exactly right. The requirements are based on different provisions in the U.S. Constitution. The requirement for equal population of congressional lines comes from Article 1, Section 2. And there the court has been quite strict indeed. There have been congressional districts with about 700,000 people per district that have deviated, Florida's the largest by 19 people, 1-9, that have been struck down as not good enough. So that requirement is really, it's really quite strict. It's aiming for zero deviation. The requirement for the state legislature is based on the 14th Amendment on the Equal Protection Clause and gives a little bit more leeway to you to secure other important state objectives, if you wish.
Thank you.
Of course. So that's the first federal mandate, is the Equal Protection requirement the Equal Population requirement. And you can see and get a sense for the sorts of numbers that you'll want to aim for. As the last question came in, aim quite precisely for with respect to Congress, and aim somewhat more loosely for with respect to the state legislature. You'll get this information from the Census Bureau, as I mentioned, the PL94-171 file, which will give you total population. Some states make adjustments to that. I believe Kansas makes an adjustment in order to take the census data and account for students and members of the military at their permanent residence. And three states now, New York, Delaware, and Maryland, make adjustments to that, or will make adjustments to this data to account for incarcerated persons at their permanent residence. I just want to take a moment to talk through the latter, because this is something you may or may not want to consider, the latitude to adjust in this fashion, at least for state legislative districts, is up to each state. The status quo in most areas of the country, curiously less so at the county level than at the state level, is that incarcerated populations are counted for redistricting purposes where they're incarcerated. But quite often, in fact, more often than not, these individuals have no relationship to the other people in the district. And what that means, essentially, is that if the incarcerated population, I'm shown here in the Southwest, if that block is incarcerated and has no relation to the rest of the district, then really the people in the rest of the district have massively disproportionate representation, which dilutes the representation that the rest of the state receives.
Professor Lovett?
Yes?
One of the members has a question. Senator Przanski.
Please.
Professor, regarding the incarcerated individuals in those states, have they actually distinguished between those that are serving sentences that would put them back to their community versus those who might be in for life or on death row?
I don't believe that distinction has been made thus far, although that would certainly be possible. Purely by numbers, I think the proportion of incarcerated individuals who are serving for life or who are on death row is very small. And so to the extent that it impacts where districts are drawn, I'm not sure that population would drive district lines in a certain direction.
I guess maybe in Texas it might, but up here it may not.
That's also entirely possible. I don't believe that distinction has been made thus far, although it would certainly be you would have that opportunity.
Thank you.
If you were considering something like this, that could certainly be
temporary residence.
The way that the states all went on that question, the way that the three states thus far have decided to adjust the census data is to count people who are incarcerated, their pre-incarceration address. And so simply to reallocate those individuals from one census block where the facility is to the census block at their pre-incarceration address. And I mention that just because it seems to be an option that has taken on more interest more recently as a way to adjust the total population data that you receive.
And Professor Lovett, have these three states passed this legislation in the last decade, or did they count prisoners at their pre-incarceration address in the last redistricting?
No, this is all new. This is all this decade. In fact, within the last 3 years, possibly 2 years for each. And so this is a growing recent interest, but it has not been performed. Kansas has been adjusting its data, I think, for at least one cycle, perhaps two.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, can I speak?
Yes, Representative Holvey has a question.
Thank you. I was curious about this adjustment. Is there, if the states do this adjustment for incarcerated people, is there any direction on the congressional districts from the Constitution or federal courts on whether or not we're allowed to do that and how much?
There isn't yet, in part because, as I believe the senator's question indicated, states haven't done it, so it hasn't been challenged. And so we don't have a lot of direction on the congressional level. There is, I think, some incremental legal risk for doing this on the congressional level just because the terrain is more uncertain. There is generally broader latitude given to the states to determine the basis for equal population on the state legislative level, and that includes decisions about where to allocate individuals. I also want to emphasize this isn't about putting people in or taking people out. This is purely a question of where. But it's an excellent question you have, and there has not been any additional incremental guidance, mostly because the policy has not been implemented, and so we haven't seen the challenges that have been resolved one way or the other.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Of course. If there are, I'm happy to take further questions about that. If there are, then I'll move on to the other.
There is, Professor. Representative Lindsay has a question.
Please.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Yeah, Professor, what's Kansas's system? Do they have a legislative body that does this, or are they on a different system?
It's an excellent question. In general, Kansas has the legislature is in charge of drawing the maps. I'm not sure whether they have a particular committee of legislators who executes this particular adjustment, or whether they've got a something like the Legislative Reference Bureau or the Bureau in charge of codification and in legislative research. Many states assists with the redistricting enterprise at the direction of the legislature. I'm not sure who physically takes the numbers in Kansas and conducts the adjustment, but yes, it is done at the direction of the legislature, as all redistricting is done at the direction of the legislature in Kansas.
Thank you.
Of course. I'm here for you, so if there are other questions, I'm more than happy to answer.
Any other questions on that issue? It doesn't look like it at this point. Thank you, Professor.
Okay, of course. And I trust that you will feel free to return me to issues where you have a particular interest if you want to hear more.
We appreciate that. Thank you.
Of course. The other large federal requirement that you will have to, or that you may have to contend with, is the requirement to account for race and ethnicity, particularly with respect to the Voting Rights Act. I'll go through the basic requirement that applies nationwide. As you'll see, it protects certain populations, and I simply don't know whether any of the populations are sufficiently large in Oregon or in parts of Oregon to fall under protection. In this respect, it's worth keeping in mind the district sizes. The threshold trigger for you is going to be about half of a district-sized population. And so the smallest size that we'll be talking about is roughly 31,000-32,000 people. So with that 31,000-32,000 people in mind, this is what the Voting Rights Act does. This is for those who work in the area. Always laugh when I try to explain the Voting Rights Act in a minute and a half. So please understand that this is truly the 100,000 foot view and the flyby of that. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is the provision that applies nationwide and the one that you will have to you'll have to comply with and or account for in Oregon. And what it basically says is, it asks three threshold questions. The first threshold question, are half of the potential voters in a concentrated area, in a relatively concentrated area, it doesn't have to be a perfect square or a circle like I've got here, are half of the potential voters in a concentrated area minorities? Do they generally vote together, or would they generally vote together for the same types of preferred candidates? Would the rest of the voters in the area generally choose different candidates? And that's not, I want to emphasize, difference by party. That's not that minorities would choose Republicans and the rest Democrats or vice versa. That applies intra-party as well. Does the minority community have a distinct electoral interest different from the remainder of the community? And do they make up? Essentially, the half of the potential voters in a concentrated area test is designed to see whether they would have the numbers to exercise control over district on their own if they were, in fact, kept together in one district. Those are the three threshold questions. Are they sizable enough, and is there what's called polarized voting? The Voting Rights Act then asks you to consider the totality of the circumstances, and there are lots of things here, but they amount to, do minorities in the area have, are there obstacles or impositions in the way of their ability to effectively exercise the electoral franchise? And lots of different factors go into that mix of different degrees of relevance in different parts of the country. If the group is sufficiently sizable, and if there is polarized voting, then the Voting Rights Act commands that you not dilute what would otherwise be the voting power of that community. And what that means is that a district be drawn that allows the minority community, the cohesively voting minority community, an equal opportunity to elect representatives of choice. That essentially preserves intact, by using the district lines, that community's voting power with an opportunity to control the results of the district. That doesn't mean that the community will all turn out, or will all turn out for any particular candidate. It's not a guarantee that somebody will be elected of that minority community, but it does preserve their opportunity to elect a candidate of choice. If the right circumstances are
right. Well, Representative Garrett has a question.
Please.
Professor, you might be getting to this next, but my question is, if you have, say, an area where minority representation is roughly half, does do not dilute mean you can't take it anywhere below half?
It means that it's an excellent question, and I'll say that on the margins of the question, jury's still out in some ways. What is clear is that you cannot, if the minority population is roughly half and would otherwise vote cohesively and be outvoted by others, that you cannot deprive them of their opportunity to control the election in that district. Now that, in my mind, doesn't necessarily mean they have to be themselves half of the district. If there are reliable crossover voting patterns, they're known as crossover voting patterns, where the minority community regularly votes for certain types of candidates and a small number of others in the community would also vote for those same types of candidates. As long as the minority community essentially was in the driver's seat, that's still fine. What it does prohibit is drawing the lines to divide up that minority community so that they're no longer in the driver's seat.
Thank you.
And Representative Lindsay has a question.
Thank you. I'm just assuming that minority is defined as your standard protected class. There's no. Is there any special language there?
That's basically right. It's racial, ethnic, or language minority. And it comes from the original mandate of the Voting Rights Act was to deny the right to vote on account of race or color. That was expanded in 1975 to include members of the language minority. And language minority generally means either American Indian or
And then I just had a follow-up question. That was, this is all based off of census data. Can't even touch registration data at all, I'm assuming.
It's based on census data, but the registration data goes to whether or not you have left minorities in the driver's seat. So the baseline population that you're looking for are potential voters. That's right. And that census that's essentially voting age population. There's some question about whether it's possible to use citizen voting age population. Most particularly because the census won't actually give you that information, at least not in the same way. The decennial census, the thing that happened on April 1st, asks questions about age, race, and ethnic background, but does not ask questions about citizenship. And the only place where that information is available is a rolling survey, more like a poll than like a full census that's conducted over time and based on slightly different geographies. So there's a running question about whether it's even possible to use that information. But the assessment of the size of the population is based on potential. If it's determined that the population is potentially big enough, and all of those other factors, okay, if there's polarized voting and if the totality of the circumstances lead you to believe that they would otherwise have less effective exercise of the electoral franchise, then the focus is very pragmatic and on the true effective opportunity that the community has to exercise control of the district. And that's where registration numbers and registration, both registration and turnout, I should say, actually do play a role. So that, for example, if registration rates were substantially below the remainder of the population, registration rates for the minority community were substantially below the rest of the population, and turnout rates were substantially below the rest of the population, then a bare 50% plus one majority might not actually be an effective opportunity district.
Professor, I'm going to interrupt for just a minute because please. Senator Beyer has a question.
Please.
Yes, go ahead.
Professor, this is curious. We do that. Obviously, the major indicator is the population, the minority population compared to the whole. But in terms of that second point of demonstrating trends, since we never know how anybody or any individual votes, what's the case law on the pattern, the evidentiary pattern that would suggest whether that occurs or not or has occurred?
That is an outstanding question, and one that you'll find many experts and academics paid very well to answer. And I will say that law professors are not among them here. I'm talking about political scientists and demographers. This is an Equal Opportunity Employment Act. The easiest answer is that it's a blend of three different measures. If you happen to have, and although Oregon may not, there are other states that certainly do, precincts at close to 100% minority level, where really you've got a precinct with 99.9% of the voters represented from one minority, even though you don't know how any individual votes, you'll know how the precinct voted, and therefore you'll know how the minority population voted if it voted cohesively, or you'll know that they did not vote cohesively. There are other precincts where there is a means to track the blended ratio of how minorities vote in that precinct and see whether it correlates with anything. So if you can imagine precincts of 10% minority population, 20% minority population, 30% all the way on up, and you also see voting results look like 10% for one particular candidate, 20% for one particular candidate, 30% for one particular candidate, all the way on up in the same line, then you've got a pretty good idea that what's driving that increase is the minority voters. Never sure, but a pretty good idea. The third technique, which is the most robust and rigorous, and the one used most often and the one that it really takes a political scientist to explain well, is based on ranges of uncertainty and looking at blended precincts where there's some minority participation but not 100% minority participation, and developing ranges of uncertainty for how that minority population might have voted given the what you do know from the precinct. And when combined with all of the other precincts in an area of the state, it's possible to come up with a range. It looks like the minority community probably voted X percent for X individual within this range of uncertainty, X percent for Y individual within this range of uncertainty. There's a lot more science underlying that than it sounds like, than I've just given you, but that also requires a lot more math, and law professors are good at.
And we essentially have 2 months to ascertain all of that.
Well, the great benefit is there may well have been people in the area, or are people in the area, including in some of the universities, who have looked at some of the information, or can look at some of the information, in the areas where the population is big enough to make you think that it might be an issue. You also may have a good feel for whether there's an issue or not. And though I wouldn't encourage you to trust that feel entirely, it might give you a sense of whether you should focus efforts on one particular community or another. I suspect that you all will know your voters in various areas very well indeed, and that may lead you to focus your attention on, well, we think we've got this community in this particular part of the Portland suburbs, for example, that will want to see whether this is the case, whether we've got the numbers, and whether they in fact vote differently.
Thank you, Professor.
Yeah, of course. So this is the mandate of the Voting Rights Act. I want to just go through one example of how it may be required to be creative, and I'm not sure the demographics work out that you'll need any of this. I think in Oregon your responsibilities may be quite a bit simpler than this. Chicago has an incredibly large and incredibly diverse community packed in the heart of the center city. Just west of downtown Chicago, in what I've called suburbs but aren't really suburbs, there are two intermingled communities, the Latino Hispanic community represented in orange, with increasingly dark shades representing increasing concentrations of voters, and the African American community represented in purple, the same thing. And though these communities live side by side, they have very different preferences who they vote for. And you can see that this is all a relatively small area of the state, so that these communities are large and fairly compact. But if you were to draw a district north to south, in order to capture most of the Latino population, you would cut directly through the heart of the African American community. And if you were to draw a district east to west, in order to capture the African American community, you'd cut right through the heart of the Latino district. And so even though the Voting Rights Act requires that these communities not be divided, and requires that each of these communities not be divided, it's not possible to draw what many consider a pretty-looking district that accomplishes the task. And so, in Chicago, the state legislature actually drew a district that I think looks quite pretty indeed, because of what it accomplishes. And this was, I know the Senator Bob Meacham was on the morning radio show, public radio show with me yesterday morning, when I was talking about judging districts by what they do, not by what they look like. And that's why I say, to me, this district is quite pretty indeed, because it actually provides each community with an opportunity to elect a candidate of choice, including the first Hispanic congressional representative from Illinois.
So I have a question, Professor.
Yes.
On that, is the Latino Hispanic district contiguous? I can't really see from a distance.
Much.
Right.
Boundary around the edge.
Yes. And the reason they did that is because this is a community that just by happenstance, this is the way they developed, settled to the north and the south of the African American community, but nevertheless voted very cohesively. And you could draw one district just including them, but that would cut right through the heart of the African American community.
Right.
And so instead, they follow through a relatively small thread all the way around the side of the African American community.
Thank you.
Beyond the Voting Rights Act, there's a lot of confusion about what is acceptable and what's not acceptable. So the Voting Rights Act does protect certain voters, as we've discussed, voters of a certain size, or communities of a certain size. The voters don't have to be any size in particular. Communities of a certain size that vote differently from the surrounding areas, the Voting Rights Act protects. Beyond that, with other groups of minorities who may not be you may not reach that threshold, it is perfectly okay to consider race and ethnicity among all of the other factors that you'll consider. The legal requirements, they just can't predominate without a really good reason. That is, district can't be run solely for minorities beyond what the Voting Rights Act protects without a really good reason. But perfectly okay to consider race and ethnicity in the mix of all of the other things that you'll consider. Before I move on to the state limitations, the Oregon state law requirements, are there additional questions on the federal requirements?
No, and Professor, just looking at the time, because we have other presentations, I think we should probably move along, and then if we have other questions, we can follow up with you.
Okay,
after.
Absolutely. And these will be quick. mostly because of these state limitations, there's only one that's required by the state constitution. The others are in place based on statutes, which you obviously have the authority to amend if you wish. I'm just going to go through very quickly these other state law limitations. Contiguity, as the question just came, just means that all parts of the district are adjacent to each other, but as we saw, it doesn't have to be by very much. The district on the left is not contiguous. The district on the right is contiguous. Political boundaries, your statutes ask you to consider existing geographic or political boundaries. It does not hem you in further in any respect, so you can determine which political boundaries are most salient to you. One note, as you do this, some people think, before they get into the maps very closely, that political boundaries are nicely nested within each other, but that's not necessarily the case. And they can split populations in quite unexpected ways. So this is Franklin County, Ohio, is the white line, and they're on the exterior. And the blood spatter portion in the center is Columbus, Ohio, the city municipal boundaries of Columbus. And as you'll see, if you rigorously follow county lines without attention to the underlying municipality, then you'll cut off a small section of Columbus in the north, a small section of Columbus in the east that spill over the county lines. Your statutes also ask you to consider communities of interest, and I know you'll be devoting some special attention to this later. Communities of interest can be defined rather broadly, and here I've given you Kansas' definition just because I think it's indicative. Oregon does not define communities of common interest more narrowly than simply stating the requirement. And here's what it means in Kansas: social, cultural, racial, ethnic, economic interests, essentially the things the population cares about. And these can and should be different in different parts of the state. What's most salient in one area will not necessarily be what's most salient in another. And it may be that In one area, a particular economic tie is most salient, and in another area, a particular cultural tie is most salient, and that's fine for them to be quote-unquote inconsistent. The origin of the requirement is to ensure that you as representatives have distinct interests to represent, and what those interests are will vary tremendously based on where in the state you are. And there are lots of options that various other states, various other entities have used in the past in order to define their communities of interest. The last criteria that state law asks you to take into account is partisanship. Oregon state law asks that you not draw lines for the purpose of favoring any political party, incumbent, or other person. And largely because I couldn't resist, I wanted to show you one example of why this might be so. In 2000, then state senator ran for Congress while living here, also Chicago. And I hope that it's coincidence that I keep using Chicago as an example of all of this. That was his residence. It's easy to find from various filings of various kinds. And he is squarely within the congressional district in 2000, where he won 30% of the vote from the incumbent member of Congress in what was, for the incumbent, I gather, something of a framing challenge. The lines were redrawn the next year, and when the lines were redrawn, that's what they looked like. And you can see that State Senator Obama's house landed a block outside of the district on every side. And you can also see that there's a park directly below his house, so it's not that there was a broader connection to the community that was fostered by this line. It was specifically designed to make sure that he was not within the district in 2002, where he mounted a fairly credible threat to the incumbent in 2000. That may be part of the impetus. This certainly isn't unique to Chicago. It happens all over the place. This may be part of the impetus that sponsored the prohibition in the statutes for favoring any particular party or person. The last requirement in the law, and this is a state constitutional requirement, is that districts be nested where possible. And that means, essentially, that assembly districts fit within Senate districts where they can. So, if this is one big Senate district and you want to draw two assembly districts, these districts would not be nested within each other. The alternative, those districts are nested, simply means that one is comprised of two of the other, or vice versa. So that's the lightning tour. There are things to keep in mind, but not, I hope, an unmanageable number of things to keep in mind. I want to leave with one very quick suggestion for how you might go about this process.
We appreciate that.
And I'm sure in addition to all of the technical tips that you'll be acquiring from various places, I can certainly talk to you more about. There were questions about sort of how things have developed over the last 10 years. I know, again, Senator, on the radio show yesterday that came up. And I think that there has become more of an urge for more transparency in this process, for meaningful opportunities for public input. This can also help you. I know you've already planned to gather community input about what the communities of common interest in the area are. That's entirely commendable. It can help you figure out what communities of interest really are, what is salient in different parts of the state. And the means to do so don't have to be very complex. This is something that I did in about 3 minutes. Given Google Maps, and it's equally possible to do the same in even shorter time with a roadmap and a magic marker, just outlining where I, given the choice, would delineate my community in Los Angeles. Others will disagree, and that's fine. But if you gather lots of this testimony, you will start to see a common core of where communities are that should be retained whole within a district. And it doesn't really have to be There are certainly ways to gather much more sophisticated versions of this, but it doesn't have to be more sophisticated in order to be useful to all of you in making your choices. That's the presentation I had planned. I know there are others, and I want to make sure that I've answered whatever questions you have. There's more where that came from, including the guide that Senator mentioned, and including myself as a resource.
Thank you. We really appreciate it. And I know Representative Holvey has a question.
Please.
Thank you. And in regards to finding more information, I was kind of curious about a little more clarity about, you know, I guess defining or exactly knowing a little bit more about what voting together means and what polarized voting is.
There are, depending on how mathematically rigorous you or mathematically comfortable you are, I'll say. The leading scholar of this is Gary King at Harvard University, and he has a number of different papers explaining the method by which he shows polarization. The leading method is called ecological inference. That's the third method I described, the one that takes blended precincts and tries to figure out how the minority community is voting. It is widely accepted in the courts as the best method we've got, and I'm more than happy to send you what I think may be the most accessible versions of his and others' writings on this, if you wish. If I can at some point get the most appropriate contact information, I'm happy to send that along.
That would be terrific, and I believe if you send it to the committee administrators, they will distribute it to the committee members. Thank you. We appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the professor? Thank you so much. This has been very valuable, and we really appreciate you putting this presentation together, especially geared toward Oregon, and we look forward to further contact with you as questions arise. We really appreciate the time you've given us today. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm more than happy to answer questions, and I certainly hope that this is helpful to you as you embark on the process.
Has been. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Do you know how to turn that on? Simple. Next, we have Aaron from Committee Services, Aaron Seiler. Thank you, Aaron. Oregon redistricting process and procedures.
I'm just waiting for him to give me back control of the screen.
Okay. I was impressed with the technology there that he was running at from Los Angeles.
Good morning, good afternoon, thank you members. I am Erin Seiler. I am a committee staff for Committee Services, but I'm also the redistricting coordinator for the Legislative Assembly this session. And what I'm going to do is just walk through a quick presentation, trying to highlight some of the points that Professor Levitt did and talk about the redistricting process from a legislative committee process. And I also begin with talking about the census and the census turnout and when we expect to see some census data, and then walk you through some of the steps we're doing to engage and answer those questions about communities of interest and those issues and to facilitate the mapping discussion. So I'm going to begin with just talking briefly about the 2000 census and that the redistricting process really began with the census. April 1st was Census Day. The mail participation rate of the return rate for Oregon was 76%, which is slightly above the national average at 72%. And then to accommodate for the remainder, the Census Bureau spent May through July visiting households, clearing people who they didn't receive questionnaires returned from, and then completing incomplete questionnaires. On December 21st, the U.S. Census Bureau announced the national population and each state population to facilitate reapportionment by the U.S. House of Representatives. Nationally, we are, as a, go ahead and quickly go out to this. There is our national population, and then this is the state percentage changes. Since 2000, Oregon has increased by about 12% in their total population. These are the gained and lost seats for the, or potential gained and lost seats for reapportionment. There was some thought, even as late as 2008, that Oregon would gain a 6th congressional seat. It's estimated that we missed it by between 41 and 42,000 people. So we will have our 5 congressional seats. So we will receive our census data as promised no later than April 1st, 2011. We do anticipate receiving it sooner. We are estimating receiving the first weeks of March. What the data will include is the race for total population, populations 18 and over, Hispanic or Latino, and non-Hispanic or Latino by race for the total population, and populations 18 and over, and total house units. Then we have the redistricting process. Just some brief history on Oregon redistricting. Back to 1951, no measures were passed by the regarding the congressional or legislative plan by the legislature. Now in 1961, they were unable to pass a congressional plan. There was a legislative plan adopted. However, it did end up in court regarding some underpopulations in Lane and Multnomah counties, and so those were corrected. In 1971, no plans were passed, and the Secretary of State drew the plan. Again, in 1981, the legislature was able to adopt, and the governor did sign a plan. However, they did leave a state senate district without a representative for 2 years, and so that had to be corrected by the Secretary of State. In 1991, the Secretary of State had to draw the plan. And then regarding the congressional plan, the legislature chose to form a special interim committee to adopt a congressional plan, and it was approved by the U.S. District Court. And then in 2001, both plans were vetoed, and the Secretary of State drew them. And then who is responsible for redistricting? The Oregon legislature is responsible for legislative and congressional redistricting.
Could I back up just for a second to the former slide? I just wanted to say that the Secretary of State drew the legislative plan, not the congressional.
Sorry, pardon that.
Just wanted to
make sure the record's clear. Yes. And then if, in fact, the legislature is unable to pass a plan or becomes vetoed, the Secretary of State will become responsible for the legislative redistricting plan, or they will also be responsible if it is successfully challenged to court, whether parts or the whole plan entirely. The Oregon redistricting timeline. The Legislative Assembly's plan must be enacted by July 1, 2011, or the responsibility goes to the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State must complete and file the plan with the Supreme Court by August 15th, which gives them roughly 6 weeks to construct a plan and meet their public participation requirements. The original jurisdiction for the plan is in the Supreme Court and becomes operative January 14th, 2013. The congressional plan, there is no constitutional or statutory deadlines for the congressional plan. Practically speaking, the deadline is in time for candidates to file for the next primary election. And then there is, this is a tree chart to kind of demonstrate the process after April 1st and after July 1st for what happens to the plan if the legislature enacts a plan or if the legislature fails to enact a plan. So how is redistricting done? Oregon uses a legislative model for redistricting, which means redistricting plans are drafted as legislative bills. They follow regular legislative process and are subject to the governor's veto.
Representative Cameron has a question.
Just go back a couple slides. We're just one more. The 2013 is when the plan.
Yes. And ballot measure 55 in 2008 amended the Constitution to change the operative date of the redistricting plan so as to not, it allows affected legislators to finish their term in their current district. And the process will be done using the census data from 2010, and the redistricting plans will be developed using that data and through the application of the statutory and constitutional requirements. So legislative support throughout this process is provided by legislative administration and legislative council. We will provide the administrative, legal, and technical support to the legislative assembly. I am Erin Seiler, and I will be doing coordinating the procedural administrative support, including management of the state redistricting website and road hearings. Gina Zedlick is your legislative counsel and drafter. Wayne Coffey, who will be giving a presentation here shortly, is your technical coordinator for redistricting. He is doing the mapping, GIS, and working with the data. And then Tana Newell is his redistricting assistant, and she'll be helping with the coordination of road hearings and also working with the public input and managing the databases for public input. So our redistricting tools that we have. The mapping software we'll be using is a combination of the ArcView GIS system and the AutoBound Pro system, which is a complete redistricting program that covers all procedures of redistricting, from building of databases to development and analysis of final plans. We have multiple online tools that we are using and also will be exploring using. We have a legislative website. We are exploring use of Twitter and Facebook as to engage more of the public in our process. We will eventually have the U.S. Census data on our website, whether a direct link to the Census Bureau or if we can house the data on our website. We're not quite sure. It depends on what format it comes to us in. We are also exploring using online survey tools, similar to what Professor Levitt mentioned about going online and using Google and drawing your community of interest, or also asking some questions about how people identify themselves within their communities. There are also some good open source software redistricting applications. One was created by Dr. Michael McDonald, who will be presenting to us in the future. And there's one that is in development, and it's the state of Florida's My District Builder. And while, yes, you are looking at Florida, but it will give people some appreciation for the difficulty involved in balancing the populations, and they have some very good data resources on there. And then there's a third one, it's called Dave's Redistricting Project, and you can go on and map congressional districts for your state, and his information was recently updated and is quite an interesting and a difficult tool to use when you're thinking about congressional districts.
And Erin, who is Dave?
Dave is a former Microsoft. It's a freeware. I can quickly bring it up here for you. It's a freeware program. He used to be a Microsoft developer.
Okay.
And so this is something he's initiated on his own and has gone out and collected data for all of the 50 states and is in the process of uploading the new census data as it's come out recently from Virginia and Kansas and Louisiana. I'll come back to that.
That's okay. It's a
program that he has taken on himself and has created. Other tool we'll be using is public participation. We'll be using capital hearings and road hearings to go out to communities around the state to investigate communities of interest and have the public come in and talk to you about how they identify with their community, what resources they would like to see, and how they perceive their communities. We will also be using video conferencing in and outside of the Capitol to facilitate as much public participation as possible. We will have public workstations in our redistricting offices, which will have the census data on it and have what's called the light version of our software, so the public can come in and look at maps that you have developed as you get there, and then also look at the data that we have available to them and do a little mapping on their own. And then moving forward from here, so before the arrival of the census data, the committees will receive presentations on communities of interest in Oregon, public participation and transparency, and the tools for participation in Oregon, population trends and demographics. After the release of the census data, which again we anticipate early March, the committees will begin the public hearing process and capital and road hearings, and they will seek input about how to address the population changes in accordance with the statutory requirements. And then after a plan is prepared, the legislature will hold public hearings on the draft plan, and it will move forward as an amended bill and akin to similar bills.
Senator Brzezinski has a question.
Aaron, I want to go back to the slide on 9. Representative Cameron asked about the operative date.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to make certain I understand what that says. On 9, it talks about the effective date of the plan is January 14, 2013. Does that mean that elections that occur in 2012 will still have the old district versus what the new districts would be?
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, I will defer to Gina Zedlick on that question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gina Zedlick from the Office of Legislative Counsel. I was going to touch on this, but I might as well do it now. So as Aaron said, ballot measure 55 in 2008 passed, was approved by the people as an amendment to the Constitution to adjust the dates of, you know, whenever you pass a plan, it will be effective immediately. But what the change in ballot measure 55 did was delay the operative date to allow for all members of the House to fulfill their entire tenure as representatives, and half of the senators may fulfill their 4 years for which they ran. Potentially, there are half the senators that may see that could be reassigned to a different district in the middle of their term.
So
you're going to pass the plan will become effective in 2011.
So there will be a
plan in 2011.
So in 2012, when we have elections,
for purposes of running for office in 2012, the plan is you run in 2012 for the new seat, the new lines that will be effective in 2013.
And everyone that's serving currently will serve out their time if they are at the end of the service, such as the representatives or half of the senators at 2012, and then it goes across. So, yeah, I was going to say if we did not actually have the elections being affected by the change until 2014, we may be a little suspect of running a little bit further into the 10-year cycle.
And also, one change that went along with that was the Constitution now says that, so if you have to assign a senator, you know, of that half that might have to be reassigned, the residency requirement is temporarily waived. Mm-hmm. In the Constitution.
Thanks, Gina.
Yeah.
May you as my senator for half a year.
Gina, do you want to just stay up there?
Stay. It was a natural segue into Gina's presentation, and so.
Terrific. Thank you, Aaron.
Yep.
Were you finished, Aaron?
I am. Unless there are any other questions that I can answer, otherwise I will defer to Gina to talk about statutes and the constitutional requirements.
Well, I think Representative Cameron has a question. Do you have a question?
Madam Chair, and I apologize for improper address before. Gina, in your last statement there, the temporary residence is waived on an appointment process between what period of time? So
if a senator is reassigned, you know, usually you have to live in your district for at least a year before the election to be a representative or senator to run. There's that residency requirement. The Constitution now clarifies that if you have to say a senator lives in Salem and suddenly with the redrawing of the lines you make him represent a population of people where he does not live, that's okay for the rest of his tenure as senator. Were you asking specifically, there are provisions regarding appointments. Is that what you were asking about?
Right.
Just
that's,
so I know.
That's
okay.
Okay. The appointment is what you made a statement at. Just clarification on that, the appointment process. I thought you said that somebody could be appointed and be outside their district when they're appointed.
Chairs, co-chairs, Representative Cameron, I think there's a couple things that are going on. So with the bill, one of the Constitution requirements for redrawing the lines is that you assign all state senators to represent a district or their area. Aaron commented on a case from, I think it was 81, where that didn't happen, where there was a population of people that were not represented and assigned a new senator. The Constitution clarifies that that senator need not live in the district to represent those people for that remainder of their two-year term that might be applicable. It might not be.
Okay. Thank you.
No. Thank you.
Okay.
Gina, you have a presentation for us?
Well, I've tried to highlight some things that haven't maybe been touched on so far. I think Professor Levitt and Aaron kind of highlighted the overview of the constitutional requirements. Mostly it's just a timeline about when things happen and who does what. And so the large umbrella that you have is, I think Professor Levitt went over it very well. You have you've got the umbrella of the federal law that applies to the drawing of the congressional districts, and then also through the 14th Amendment filters down to affect the state lines as well. And then within that, we have here in Oregon statutory requirements, and those are, where did I put them? That each district be contiguous, of equal population, utilize existing geographic or political boundaries, not divide communities of interest, and be connected by transportation links as nearly as practicable. There are also, as you know, that the lines can't be drawn to for the purpose of favoring any political party, incumbent legislator, or any other person, or to dilute the voting strength of any language or ethnic minority group. And then the statute also echoes the constitutional mandate to nest two House districts within one Senate district.
Any questions? Did you have more to present? I know you're around. Senator Beyer.
On the equal population number, now the federal law is fairly generous. I think the case law is as much as 10% deviation. But the Oregon statute talks to is equal as practicable.
Right.
Has there been any case law on that?
I think in the past the 10% deviation comes from federal courts, and that's just as much as there has been a case where that was okay. That doesn't mean that's always okay. And again, this process is basically a very big balancing test that goes along with drawing the lines. And so I think it was the last time the Secretary of State adopted a range of 2%, and that was upheld by the courts this last time. So for any population deviation, you basically need to say why you're doing it. And the reasons why you can do it are outlined in statute and case law.
So the shorthand is get them as equal as you can.
And if you don't have a good reason.
Yeah, have good reason.
Representative Garrett has a question.
Gina, maybe is there more to your presentation, or should...
This is...
I just wanted to know if you could tell us if there's case law or any other authority on defining communities of interest beyond what we see in the statute. And a related question is, I don't think we have any experience with Section 2 Voting Rights Act in this state, but can you comment on that, whether to what degree we have to be conscious of that as we go about this?
Sure. Representative Garrett, members of the committee, as far as case law goes on defining communities of interest, not to my knowledge, we don't have that sort of guidance, unfortunately. I think the practical answer and the advice I would give on that note, though, is to, and there have been, there is federal, we can use federal court cases to look to for guidance about what might be a good idea for you to consider. And I think, having basis in fact and being able to articulate those interests and also to create a very, the public record and to document those and what you learn about. And I think ultimately it's up to you as the body to decide what interests are valuable in this process. And I guess that would be my advice in light of the lack of court guidance.
Gina, Professor Lovett put up a Kansas statute that had at least a general definition of communities of interest. Do you know, do other states define communities of interest better than ours?
Tara Bonamici, I actually don't know. Erin?
I can chair by me, two members of the committee. Some states, like Kansas, have some very specific definitions. Some, like ourselves, have a very general definition. There's no consistency in how states apply communities of interest and how they've chosen to define that for themselves. It is entirely a state-by-state observation. They have similar concepts of what communities of interest are related to ethnic, language minorities, transportation, current government boundaries, but there is no single comparator across the board, just some common identities.
Any other questions, Regina? Thank you so much. I know you'll be around.
She's going to get to the voting rights.
Voting rights. Oh, sorry. Sorry about
That's
that.
That's okay.
She may not want to.
Well, my answer is fairly simple, is that Oregon has no history of dealing with that. That isn't to say that that might change, but if it did change, this would be the first year to look at that data to determine. And I think as Professor Lovett's presentation concluded, there's a lot of factors that go into that and would need a lot of analysis, so maybe in the future.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Next we have Wayne Coffey from Committee Services to tell us about the technology and the census. Welcome.
Chairman Bonamici, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. We're going to talk a little about the use of geographic information systems and how it enables redistricting. Redistricting for 2011, as I understand it, we're going to be developing a strategy, putting together our population data, developing a training for the members of different groups within the legislature. Primarily, we want to prioritize what the strategy is going to look like and how to communicate what the data means as we move through the process here. So a redistricting strategy is going to involve ultimately moving boundaries from the present state, dealing with really large and sensitive data sets. Primarily, their data is going to come from the U.S. Census Bureau. However, the data will also use some local data as well. I'm going to talk in a few slides ahead what that data looks like. Primarily, we use census blocks to draw the boundaries, and that's going to be the primary geography that we work from. And so I'll describe that a little bit more in detail. The idea behind a GIS is that it's a really powerful tool to organize all of this data. So what is GIS? Geographic Information Systems. It's a platform that organizes the data spatially by coordinate systems or by some kind of location code, as like in a zip code or survey coordinates. I think it's really important to state that the access to the software now is very broad. Anybody, if they want to, can get this data in with online applications. There's a lot of things that can be taken advantage of, but and GIS is a very complex tool, and while lots of people can take advantage of the tool sets, they need to understand what the outcomes would be. So I just want to stress that having a background, at least with some statistical analysis and geographic and cartographic concepts, are also important in the process. So keeping that in mind as this goes to a more public level. And what I want to point out here is just that an errand Seiler stated in her presentation briefly that there's a lot of nomenclature, a lot of terminology that gets thrown around with GIS. The primary platform that we're working with is ArcGIS, and it's a product of a company called ESRI. That name will probably be you'll hear that name a lot. What we're talking about is AutoBound, and AutoBound is a tool which interfaces with ArcGIS. So I just want to make that distinction clear. And we, if anyone is interested in more details on that, I'm happy to talk about it in person. So the data we're going to be using, and I'm going to go through a number of slides here that just kind of detail the different scales of the data bound to geography really quick. The basic, most granular form of census data is going to be the census tabulation block, and it's essentially the entire geography of the U.S. Carved up into different layers. Many of them are not populated. They just represent features in the landscape or recognized boundaries. Those are then organized into block groups to assemble some kind of population. Between 600 to 3,000 is the operative number that they seek there. The next level would be a census tract. And census tract is probably the one that's most recognized because most of the intercensal data, like from the ACS and the long form, is tabulated to this geography level. But we also have within that, we have municipal boundaries. And so we have incorporated cities, which the Census Bureau recognizes. But it also adds to that with what they call census designated place, which just represents population concentration that is recognizable urban center. School districts are recognized by the Census Bureau and usually are used to delineate some of the boundaries within census blocks and tracts. So they recognize that, as well as legislative districts and in the counties. It's important to note here that all the blocks, block groups, and tracts are aggregated up to county boundaries. None crosses a county boundary. Other data that gets used or potentially used if wanted is a long list, and that's certainly up to us to decide. Not that boundaries are going to, the legislative boundaries will fix to this, but could be used in determining just as a guide to where we may want to go with how boundary is going to look in terms of things like communities of interest and such. There's lots of data out there. Most of it's derived from different federal and state agencies. DAS here within the state does maintain a website with that data available. It doesn't necessarily conform to the census TIGER files. I can talk more about that if somebody's interested. And then there's supplementary data from local areas, counties, metro councils, and city governments that are worth considering as well. A quick note again on this last slide, this last bullet here: water and transportation networks are included in the census files, but they don't necessarily follow what other agencies may consider, like what a waterway looks like. So important if you're looking at two different sets of data, they may not look very much alike. So how does this work with AutoBound? Again, this is just a quick slide to illustrate the difference in the platforms that are used. The top slide, this top image here, just shows what the basic Esri platform looks like. The bottom one shows GIS with the AutoBound tools affixed into it. So quickly here, I'll run through some slides that demonstrate how AutoBound will work for building a district. So in this case, here, a set of blocks, census blocks, are selected within an existing legislative district. The blocks are then, using a tool, are assigned. So the entire population of all these blocks are assigned to a single value down here within that district. Once it's assigned, it shows the new population value and measures it against the target population we're seeking and shows a deviation value for that district. As you move through the process, there's a lot of management tools that allow you to undo, merge, combine districts, do a number of things. One important part here is to consider when a district's assigned and you want to change the value. It's very simple here with AutoBound. You can undo the assignment, reassign it, remove census blocks, assign it again, and you've got a new value. So even for someone without a lot of tech savvy here, the software with a little assistance would be pretty easy to use. Also, as you're moving through the process, you can pull up graphical displays. It has some interactive intelligent tools that guide you through directions that you might want to consider as you move through the process. This is just another example of the matrix down here, the table matrix. And as you're moving through it, also can keep track of different levels of racial demographics. It has a voting age in there by default, so I know we're not considering that, so that's not worth thinking. But we can add to this matrix as we want and interact and create our own custom matrix to follow, and that could fit in again with communities of interest. This is a plan that once a plan's completed, you can see you can track the deviations here in this column, and then there's different settings here under the toolbars that can allow you to see different districts that are just contiguous to your selected district here. So we're looking at District 19. You could select as we're just looking at deviations surrounding that district. other tools.
Senator Beyer has a question.
Yes.
Yes. As you do this, I'm assuming in this example you have all 60 legislative districts represented. So if we're focusing on, the Springfield District 12, and you're moving that around, does that automatically, as you adjust that, change the other 59 districts as well?
Chair Bonamici, Senator, that's correct. It is constantly updating. As anything is changed, it immediately readjusts every boundary and deviation. It's very intelligent in that way. Within the basic ESRI tool set, there's tools to do that, but they're all isolated. What AutoBound has done is it's taking those tools and it's building sort of a macro processing tool that it tells. So it's a very complicated tool set, but it keeps saving us from having to go through and manually go through each step.
And to follow up on Senator's question, so that's almost simultaneous. As you ask for that information, it's going to make the adjustments, so you'll see it basically in real time.
Correct. The only issue is that because we're dealing with census blocks and there's different levels of geography you can work with, that it's a very large data set, so instantaneous, and we expect things really fast, but it's a large data set, so I mean you could be sitting there for 5 minutes or so to 10 minutes to wait for the process, but it's certainly not going to be an all day procedure.
Thank you.
Another example of tool sets. Once you've completed a plan, there's a number of editing tools you can go through that run checks, looks for splits, they look for discontinuities, open spaces, blocks that aren't assigned, and provides a number of step-by-step tools to make those corrections as you go. So it's not a matter of having to go through and visually search for holes in the data. It's all built in.
And Representative Lindsay has a question.
Thank you. So my concern here is that there's one database with all the census data, and then I'm assuming that those of us and you and the administrative services that have access to the application can create as many plans as they want, correct? And we'll just name those like any other Word document type thing. Is that correct?
Senator Bonamici, Representative Lindsay, that is correct, and in fact it's even better than that, because you can maintain each individual that's allowed into the account can have their own file and their own organizational tools to maintain, so they can be walled off so people aren't in there tinkering with each other's plans. It's more intuitive than just having them all stored in one folder. We can actually have them all broken up and different. As we customize tools, we can have different versions of things that we're getting.
And a follow up to that: what about merging? Say that Representative Garrett agrees with my plan, and we merge all together. Is that
absolutely? That's possible. In fact, the software has figured that out ahead of time and knows that that's a possibility. There's even a tool that allows you to take plans, overlay them, and automatically compare places where there's overlap and refocus a new plan on those areas of overlap to help build a compromise.
I just want to make a clarifying comment, because I know Gina's still here, that there's, it seems like an infinite number of possibilities in terms of that, but having things drafted into amendments and bills is extremely limited, because it's the way that the bill is drafted is by listing all the census tracts, and so every time somebody does a plan, they can't have it drafted into an amendment, or Gina will be here 24/7 drafting numbers. So that's where we have the limitation in having things drafted. So we can talk about that afterwards.
So from that, at this point, that was a really, I just wanted to provide a brief demonstration of some of the Autobahn tools. You know, again, it does give you some good graphic interface and reports, which I don't know if it was made aware. The representative from Autobahn is here today actually walking me through some training steps, and it is possible to recustomize these reports to fit whatever we want to seek the output. This is a default reporting tool. If there's no more questions about Autobahn, I do have a couple quick slides of some of the current ACS data as it relates to the legislative districts, if we want to look at that. I think most have seen some of the maps that have been around. But
that would be helpful, and perhaps if we have further questions for you, we can follow up afterward, because we still have another presentation. So
okay.
If you can go through the remainder of the slides, it'd be helpful.
So this represents the current House districts and the population deviation. I haven't put hard numbers up here because there is some confusion about why the numbers don't seem to measure up with what different districts were thought to be, and I just want to point out, as we mentioned before, the ACS data is based on estimates, and those estimates can vary since it's a five-year aggregate, so some of those estimates may represent different years at different times. So the idea here is just to get a sense of the trends of where concentrations are and where the push and pull is going to be overall. So we can quickly move through the House districts. And just to point out, blue would indicate that the district's going to need to grow in some way, capture more population, and red is going to be need to give up a considerable amount of population to someone else. Senate here, generally, obviously, the trend's going to be the same, but some of these House districts kind of cancel each other out based on this data. And I'm going to show the congressional districts next. Now, District 2 over there in Eastern Oregon, I suspect the data has got some catching up to do with what the assumptions are about that population, but just in general, that's what the data is telling us so far. And this is just a quick, there's also, I have Portland in here. In a little more detail.
Any questions? No. Thank you so much. It was a lot of information in a short period of time. I certainly appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate your good
and
questions.
And our final presentation will be Barry Pack from the Secretary of State's office. And Barry's going to talk about what happens over at the Elections Office and the Secretary of State's office once there's a plan. How is it implemented? How does it go into effect? Welcome, Barry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, co-chairs, and members of the committee. For the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. I believe Aaron has provided you with some written testimony submitted by Tim Scott, the Director of Multnomah County Elections. Normally, when we do this presentation, it's a joint effort, so but unfortunately, Tim was unavailable today. But that testimony represents...
Do we have that?
I emailed it this morning, but it'll be provided to you. Some of you have seen it before. I've tried to incorporate some of the highlights that he would like to have had stressed in what I'm going to say today, but you'll have his full written testimony. After any redistricting plan is adopted, the work doesn't end there. As Senator Bonamici said, we have to partner with our county clerks to implement that plan and ensure a smooth and effective election in 2012. Before I get to that specifically, though, I wanted to touch on one other point, which is sort of the broader context of what happens throughout this year. While most of the media, and certainly your attention, is focused on the legislative and congressional plans, there are a lot of other political subdivisions of the state that redistrict after the decennial census. Counties, cities that elect their boards of commission by district, school boards, special districts, metro, all, you know, there's just countless other jurisdictions that are also drawing lines. They draw them under all of their own statutory authority, under some often different criteria within those statutes than each other, and usually without any set deadline. Some jurisdictions are governed by their own charter. Washington County, for instance, has its own charter which sets some deadlines for their process of redistricting. But it all is happening all at the same time that you will be looking at your plans, and frequently those other districts' boundaries are drawn well before you've concluded your work or before the plan falls to the Secretary of State or ends up in the courts. So this is my second round of redistricting, my first in the Office of Secretary of State, and I continue to learn more about all these other districts that draw these boundaries. I'll tell just a very brief story. We got a call from a lawyer at TriMet asking when redistricting would be done, and so we gave her the deadlines of the legislature and all this, and she called back and said, no, TriMet's redistricting. And I said, I don't know. Why would... And then she very kindly pointed out to me ORS 267090, which sets the responsibility for redistricting mass transit districts to the Secretary of State. Who knew? So I don't know the answer to her question of when we'll be doing that, but we will be doing it. To help bring some order to this chaos of all of these districts drawing boundaries, the 2010 legislature passed Senate Bill 998, which in part, it did many things, but in part gave the Secretary of State directive authority over any local government that districts after each decennial census. And the purpose of that directive is to establish a set of uniform and consistent criteria for every districting entity to follow as nearly as practicable. The hope is that there'll be greater consistency around all of the various criteria that can be considered, that you'll have more overlap of boundaries and geographic features that may be incorporated in all of these. It doesn't take away any local government's authority at the end of the day to make decisions. It's the same sort of parameters that you will follow when you draw your plans. You've got a set of criteria that you need to follow, but you need to balance all of them into a reasonable, as nearly as practicable plan. We haven't issued that directive yet. We won't until the census data comes out. We are to do it before the legislature enacts a plan or we enact a plan. I think our hope is to follow the deliberations of these two committees, see how you discuss the various criteria that you will be following so we can incorporate that feedback into our directive and try and continue as much the consistency and uniformity. So, moving on to the next steps then. Whenever a legislative plan is enacted, the job then falls to the county to reconcile all of these plans together. They take the legislative and congressional plans and begin drawing precincts. The counties generally try to create as few precincts as possible with as few splits as possible, and a split occurs whenever there's a jurisdiction, say a city or a county district, that is not entirely encompassed within the precinct. Fewer precincts and fewer splits translate into fewer ballot styles, and that means a cheaper and more efficient election to administer. So they really try to keep those to a minimum, and I will at the end share some lessons learned from the counties about things that you may consider that will help them avoid too many precincts and too many splits. And whenever you have districts that are adjacent and neighboring, it's really important for all of those districting entities to work together and communicate. That will help facilitate the county's clerk's processes at the end of the day. The other major task then that we work with the clerks on is to actually assign voters to the proper precinct to make sure they get the proper ballot to vote for the contest they are actually qualified to vote on. New technology will help with this. We are working to find the best solution to integrate GIS capabilities with our centralized voter registration database. so that when the plans actually come down to the county clerks and they have to go find all of the right voters and put them in all the right precincts, a lot of that is already done. If the GIS can be linked into our existing database, then it will save the county clerks a massive amount of data entry. And when I mention a couple timelines soon, you'll see why that's important. It will also help our office implement some legislation from 2009, which said that if a county clerk notifies us that a candidate for office lives within 100 radial yards of a district boundary, we are to go in and actually confirm residency. And you may recall this was originated out of a controversy in the 2008 election. Finally, the county clerks must determine the number of precinct committee persons the two major parties will have in each precinct, and this must often be done in a very short period of time. The worst case scenario is, as you've seen before, a plan will be enacted no later than December 15th of this year. And by law, county clerks have until January 31st to determine, to draw all of the precincts, and then determine the number of precinct committee persons, which is established by population in the precinct, and report that to the county. So they have 45 days to reconcile all of these plans together, draw their precincts, and get all that information out. And as Tim will point out in your written his written testimony, that there is historical precedence for the counties not getting a plan till December. So he's planning accordingly, I'm sure. So finally, to conclude, I'll just pass along some of the lessons learned that the county clerks have shared. The criteria that's in the statute and the Constitution, and then obviously in any directive that we issue to a local government, should be consistently followed and applied. And if it's not, if there's deviation, it's very helpful to the county clerks for an explanation why. And I'll give an example. If one of the criteria is to consider existing geographic and political boundaries. Well, if you make a decision that a certain existing boundary can't be accommodated within a given district because of reason X, Y, and Z, and so you make a difference, you split a city in half or something, just providing some explanation about the reasoning behind that decision will help them figure out as they draw precincts how to best accommodate that. They would recommend largely as possible to use boundaries that don't change. Tax lots is a great example. Tax lots fairly rarely change, and so splitting a tax lot can create problems. Problem was created in 2008 with a tax lot that was split down the district. The choice was made to follow a stream. And that stream had, since the last time that particular database was updated, had been tilled under and became a culvert, and no one could see it. So it was really hard to find, actually, logistically, where that line was. And that split tax lot resulted in a candidate whose property was in two different districts, and the house in one, the postal address in another, and that created a problem. So they recommend not splitting tax lots and keeping in consideration any of these boundaries that could change over the course of time. We all know rivers and streams change. They suggest avoiding dividing cities by congressional or state legislative lines, and when necessary, obviously, to consider the communities of interest, particularly school districts. They also change relatively rarely, and so it's a more stable district to consider as you are making decisions. And then finally, and I strongly encourage this, is throughout your process to allow clerks and election officials time to provide you feedback on draft plans that you're providing. Our county clerks are local experts on their areas and may have some suggestions from an administrative perspective that would help make elections more easy to administer in the future whenever any plan is adopted. And with that, I'll conclude and thank you for your time and answer any questions.
Thank you so much. I think this is really helpful for us to keep in mind the implications of what happens after the plan is done. Questions for Barry? Thank you very much.
Great.
Committee, thanks for staying almost to the end. We finished just only 5 minutes early. I wanted to let you know that the co-chairs and the vice chair and I will be meeting shortly to work on a proposed schedule for the road trips And we're also working on a questionnaire for member input so we can start getting input from the current members in both the House and the Senate side. So we're working on that. We should have more information for all the committee shortly on those issues. We are planning on doing road trips that are the furthest distance early on and then staying closer to the Capitol later on as the session progresses. So we'll have more information about that shortly. We also, it is our goal to have as many joint hearings as possible so that all of us are hearing the same information, hearing each other's questions and hearing all the answers. We'll do our best to accommodate that. And also, thanks to everyone for being willing to come on Friday mornings. This was the only window of time when there weren't any other committee members, any of the committee members in other hearings, so we appreciate that. And with that, I'll close the Senate Committee on Redistricting.
No. We close.